myself. It contributes to my happiness. And needing a friend, after one of the walks every day, we sit and have a cup of coffee together and we have a wonderful visit. And so I'm getting a lot out of it. And, you know, now I'm starting to understand how happiness works.
And one more personal joy for myself, that I've been invited by Cal State Fullerton to join their part-time faculty teaching information systems. We know there are many more joys and sorrows unspoken, and we will continue to hold everyone in our thoughts. The American Humanist Association has worked for many years to evolve the document known as the Humanist Manifesto. The current version is Humanist Manifesto 3, which states, "Humanism is a progressive philosophy of life that, without supernaturalism, affirms our ability and responsibility to lead ethical lives of personal fulfillment that aspire to the greater good of humanity. The life stance of humanism, guided by reason, inspired by compassion, and informed by experience, encourages to live life well and fully. It evolved through the ages and continues to develop through the efforts of thoughtful people who recognize that values and ideals, however carefully wrought, are subject to change as our knowledge and understandings advance." This statement is part of an ongoing effort to manifest in clear and positive terms the conceptual boundaries of humanism, not what we must believe, but a consensus of what we do believe. It is in this sense that we affirm the following. Knowledge of the world is derived by observation, experimentation, and rational analysis. Humanists find that science is the best method for determining this knowledge, as well as for solving problems and developing beneficial technologies. We also recognize the value of new departures in thought, the arts, and inner experience, each subject to analysis by critical intelligence. Humans are an integral part of nature, the result of unguided evolutionary change. Humanists recognize nature as self-existing. We accept our life as all and enough, distinguishing things as they are from things we might wish or imagine them to be. We welcome the challenges of the future and are drawn to and undaunted by the yet to be known. Ethical values are derived from human need and interest as tested by experience. Humanists ground values in human welfare shaped by human circumstances, interests, and concerns, and extend to the global ecosystem and beyond. We are committed to treating each person as having inherent worth and dignity, and to making informed choices in a context of freedom consonant with responsibility. Life's fulfillment emerges from individual participation in the service of humane ideals. We aim for our fullest possible development and animate our lives with a deep sense of purpose, finding wonder and awe in the joys and beauties of human existence, its challenges and tragedies, and even in the inevitability and finality of death. Humanists rely on a rich heritage of human culture and the life stance of humanism to provide comfort in times of want and encouragement in times of plenty. Humans are social by nature and find meaning in relationships. Humanists long for and strive toward a world of mutual care and concern, free of cruelty and its consequences, where differences are resolved cooperatively without resorting to violence. The joining of individuality and interdependence enriches our lives, encourages to enrich the lives of others, and inspires hope of attaining peace, justice, and opportunity for all. Working to benefit society maximizes individual happiness. Progressive cultures have worked to free humanity from the brutalities of mere survival and to reduce suffering, improve society, and develop global community. We seek to minimize the inequities of circumstance and ability, and we support a just distribution of nature's resources and the fruits of human effort so that as many as possible can enjoy a good life. Humanists are concerned for the well-being of all, are committed to diversity, and respect those of differing yet humanist views. We work to hold the equal enjoyment of all human rights and civil liberties in an open, secular society, and maintain it is a civic duty to participate in the democratic process and a planetary duty to protect nature's integrity, diversity, and beauty in a secure, sustainable manner. Thus engaged in the flow of life, we aspire to this vision with the informed conviction that humanity has the ability to progress towards its highest ideals. The responsibility for our lives and the kind of world in which we live is ours and ours alone. Let us be together in a moment of silent reflection. Peace be with us and with all under the sun.
Get ready for the day I will rage. I am great.
I Look at the World by Langston Hughes. I look at the world from awakening eyes in a black face, and this is what I see. This fenced-off narrow space assigned to me. I look then at the silly walls through dark eyes and a dark face, and this is what I know. That all these walls oppression builds will have to go. I look at my own body with eyes no longer blind, and I see that my own hands can make the world that's in my mind. So let us hurry, comrades, the road to find.
Good morning. It's a real privilege to be with you this morning. It's been a few years since I've been at a pulpit in a church, and it feels both familiar and strange, I suppose, but it's very good to be here, and thank you for inviting me. Thank you, Mark, for the invitation. There's a song, a hymn I grew up singing. You may know it. And if you do know it, you probably have a little bit more work to do to imagine what I'm asking you to imagine, because you'll have to sort of unlearn some things about that song. You have to pretend like you haven't heard it. Because I want you to think about how this song makes you feel and how you would describe what's happening in this song. So here's a portion of the lyrics. What a fellowship, what a joy divine, leaning on the everlasting arms. What a blessedness, what a peace is mine, leaning on the everlasting arms. Leaning, safe and secure from all alarms. Leaning on the everlasting arms. Another verse says, what have I to dread? What have I to fear? Leaning on the everlasting arms. I have blessed peace with my Lord so near, leaning on the everlasting arms. How many of you know that song? Familiar to you? Oh, not as many as I thought. That's great. How does the song make you feel? Dependent, okay. That could be a good thing or a bad thing, I suppose. Probably a, do you mean it? How do you mean it? Bad thing, yeah, that's kind of what I thought. Someone else said?
Comforting.
Okay, that's the other side of the coin, right? Someone to lean on. There's another song that says, lean on me, right? So we're familiar with the idea of leaning on one another when we need to. How else does it make you feel?
Safe.
Safe, right? And words right there in the song. And years and years of singing it can make one feel quite safe and secure. Like there's somebody there to catch you if you fall, right? Like there's somebody there as a backup. Yeah. Yes, it is exactly that. God is a pair of arms, right? A pair of everlasting arms. It makes me think of being a child or my own child sort of running to me and I scoop them up in my arms and thinking about how strong and safe those arms can feel when you're small or even when you're not so small, just when you're feeling a little battered. One of the children said something about giving a hug to someone, right, to make them feel happy, and those arms, if they're not everlasting, right, can make us feel that way. I thought of this song not too long ago when I was thinking about the idea of Christian promises, the Christian promises that I grew up with, and I think this song pretty fairly summarizes that. And the promise of Christianity is rooted in the promise of eternal life, a new earth. And the basic element of that teaching is that you can't really die. You can't die permanently. You can die temporarily, but in the end, if you're on God's side, you'll live forever. And not just you, but everyone who accepts God's offer of salvation, and not just that, but all evil and corruption, even death itself, will be destroyed. That's sort of the Christian promise that I grew up with, probably some of you grew up with as well. And according to the story, at some point in the relatively near future, Jesus would return to earth with all the heavenly host. The stubbornly unrepentant would be destroyed, not by God's wrath so much, of course, as by the brightness of his goodness, sort of like a vampire by the daylight, right? And long story short, God would destroy the earth by fire, thereby purifying it. Again, a good thing, not a bad thing. And then create the new earth, full circle, back to the Garden of Eden, a garden paradise that God intended. That's the picture, in short, of the Christian story that I grew up with. The core promise of this Christian story is that we'll live forever. And embedded within that promise are a host of other promises. And one is that nothing bad could truly happen to you. Right? Nothing bad could ever really happen to you. You might die, but according to the Christian story, that's not the end of the story. That's not even the worst thing that could happen to you. You might even be tortured and die a horrible death. But that can't actually hurt you. There's martyrs that we, as Christians, celebrated as people who died painful deaths of torture. And these were not bad things, but even perhaps good things. In Matthew chapter 10, Jesus gathers 12 disciples to him and gives them some final instructions before sending them out to evangelize in his name around Palestine. And he said, "Don't be afraid of those who can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both body and soul in hell." A few sentences later, Jesus continues, "Whoever finds their life will lose it, and whoever loses their life for my sake will find it." One of those sort of profundities that we puzzled over in seminary. Dallas Willard, the late USC philosopher, was an important voice in my personal theological formation, and one of his thoughts that I embraced so deeply in my formative theological years was that in the kingdom of God, nothing could truly harm you. The worst that could happen wasn't ultimate. You are truly safe in the everlasting arms. Another promise, a corollary perhaps to the big promise, is that in spite of appearances, everything is going to be okay. Right? And right about now, as you pick up the morning paper or turn on the news or the radio or get in your car and flip on NPR, you could use a promise like that, right? About now, that no matter what's going on, no matter what happens, it's all going to be okay. It's the kind of thing we tell our children, right? All the while in the back of our mind going, hopefully, right? We hope it's going to be okay. Not just individual believers are going to just be okay, but the whole social order. Martin Luther King Jr. captures this philosophy so perfectly when he quotes the often unnamed apparent author of this statement, that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. People sometimes ask me what I miss most about being a Christian or what I appreciated most about Christianity, and it's this idea right here that I miss the most, that the arc of the universe is long and that it bends towards justice. That means that whether I experience defeat or success today, that's not the end of the story. The long arc of the universe is bending. I'm pulling on it, and I might not see it bend, but it's bending. It's quite clear that Dr. King thought that it didn't just bend by itself, however, and sometimes that statement is used in that way, that don't worry, it'll just bend. His life and the story of his life is a mountain of evidence that he thought that he had and others had to participate in bending that arc. But behind this aphorism, behind this pleasing quote, is a confidence that God, in King's case, makes sure in the long run that everything works out. Another popular aphorism along these lines, often attributed to John Lennon, who was no fan of religion, of course, says that everything will be okay in the end. If it's not okay, it's not the end. Gosh, I love that statement so much. If only it were true. It's such a great comment, a great statement. So when it happens that you discover that there's no God, as I did in my life, this becomes a promise, a problem for these promises. The promise maker isn't there anymore in your mind and in your reality, and therefore the promises are somewhat empty. And I've spoken dozens of times over the past 5 years about how I came to the suspicion that there's no God and that the promises of the Bible are empty. And I've spent a great deal of time during those 5 years in and among the atheist and humanist communities, And in these communities, there is a seemingly insatiable appetite for apologetics and counter-apologetics, debates with people who want to believe that there's a God and those that want to convince you that there isn't one. And I have fun with those, probably like many people do. It's an interesting thing to watch, like a boxing match, right? I sort of cringe, but I can't look away, you know? And I receive, sometimes monthly, unsolicited books, usually self-published. I'm glad you got the joke, yes, that's good. From the author about the unreliability of the Bible, the problems with Christian theology, arguments against religious faith, and sometimes more, scientific discoveries. And every time I receive one of these books with a little post-it note from the author, it's clear to me that the author thinks that he, and it's usually a he, is the first one to think of these things. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to put that one on a special bookshelf that usually ends up in the dumpster. Unfortunately, I hate to waste the paper, but I've just read these arguments so many times, and they've been presented in so many different ways. But there is an insatiable appetite for this conversation, for this debate about God or no God. And indeed, religious faith has done an astounding amount of damage throughout history. Reason, I believe, is a much better framework for thinking and decision-making than faith in gods and angels and spirits. But I've sort of grown bored with these books. In fact, I never really loved them, truth be told. I was never really into Christian apologetics. I always felt it was sort of missing the point. And I think atheist counter-apologetics largely misses the point as well. Though I think the point itself is worth making. From time to time, there's so much more to the story in my mind. I want us to be able to make the move from understanding the fatal flaws of theism, as I understand them, to acting in line with those discoveries. It's one thing to know something is true, it's another to incorporate those truths into your life and begin to live in a different way. The reason for me, discovering that Santa Claus is not real was a much easier idea to onboard in my life is that it's not woven into every aspect of my life. Yes, I cried. I was deeply distraught, actually, at the discovery that Santa was make-believe for about a half a day. I mean, I'm guessing. I really don't remember exactly, but I do remember some things about it. I was in the back seat of the car with my brother next to me, my mom and dad in the front seat. Probably my dad was driving, though I don't remember exactly. And somehow it slipped, or my parents thought it was time that a 7-year-old should know the truth. And I cried. I remember being shocked, devastated even. But against my better judgment, I believed my parents again. And then I got over it. I never went to any conferences for people who don't believe in Santa. I didn't seek the help of a therapist. I didn't join a support group for people who deconvert from Santaism, which is different than Satanism. Only one letter difference, but it's an important difference. And why is that? Why is it different that way? Why don't I go to a support group for people who don't believe in Santa? It's because Santa doesn't matter, like at all, right? And we get it, it's a story, we're told that at a pretty young age. But God is different. God is everything, right? We're taught that, you know, if those of us that grew up in a religious framework, we're taught that God is everything. And important for this conversation, God is the truth. And if you're taught for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years that God is not just tells the truth, but is in God's self the truth, and that person turns out to not be there, well, that's a pretty big discovery. Right? That's a pretty eye-opening, reality-shifting kind of thing that probably does warrant a therapist and a support group and perhaps some conferences and books. The Bible poorly reflects the truth of God. It's bigger than any book or any mouthpiece, but God, the Apostle Paul says God is all in all. And so when you discover the truth about that, it's pretty devastating. So I want to argue this morning that atheism does have a moral valence. A lot of times atheists will say there's no morality attached to atheism. It's just a simple belief that there's no God. Doesn't mean anything else. You can have that belief and do whatever you want, which is true, technically. But I think there are moral consequences to being an atheist, whether we like it or not. And my basic outline of my argument is as follows. The God hypothesis includes the claim that all goodness is rooted in God. But there is no God. That's the second premise. Absence of evidence for God is so overwhelming and devastating that I feel confident in saying I believe there's no God. Not just the lack of a belief in God, but I feel pretty confident in the positive claim that there is not a God. No one's coming to save us. There are no promises. There are no guarantees. The third premise is that goodness exists. There are things that are objectively good, like a hug that child was talking about a second ago. That's objectively good when it's welcome. And consequently, there are things that are objectively bad and wrong. Conscious, sentient life is good and preferable to death, all things being equal. Therefore, we should take care of conscious and sentient life. Moreover, we should take care of the environments and resources necessary for the flourishing of life, both natural environments and built environments. So if there is no God, and if goodness exists, and if what is good should be cared for and what is bad should be resisted or eliminated, then we who do not believe in God are responsible for each other. We're ethically bound to each other. We need to act in ways that make for human flourishing. And as an aside, the deep sense of community that we're all longing for and that no one can quite put their finger on only happens when we understand that we're bound to each other in this way. And I think that's why congregations like this are so important. So for me, atheism meant waking up to this reality, getting sober in a way. There's no rescue party on the way. It's you and me. Sometimes that's good news. Sometimes that's maybe not so good news. It's just us, right? You're stuck with me, and I'm stuck with you. And then we get on with the urgent matter of engaging in the only struggle that really matters. Not endlessly debating whether or not there's a God, but figuring out how we achieve freedom and our full humanity. And this entails a long and involved conversation and debate, understanding what makes actually for human flourishing. But we must engage it. And this is the bridge, I think, between atheism and humanism that everyone who's not a cynic or a nihilist must cross. Our lives are lived in the tension between freedom and responsibility. At some moments, and for some people, freedom is the greater mandate. At other times, and for other people, responsibility is greater. But understanding this tension is vital if we're to live lives that make for human flourishing, both for ourselves, other sentient animals, and the environments and institutions that those lives depend on. And what makes for human flourishing are the things that maximize freedom. The way we spend our time and other resources, the people who we enter into relationships of solidarity with, and the causes we engage in ought to be informed by this calculus about freedom and responsibility. And taken together, this is what I call radical humanism. It is a love for life, including the things that living beings create, like art and music and architecture. But it's not just sentimentality. Radical humanism squarely faces the cruel, the ugly, and the hateful. It looks fear in the face and doesn't back down or call for backup. The love of life that radical humanism embraces is not a denial of reality, but a wholehearted embrace of reality, the good and the bad. Radical humanism knows that there are no promises. No one is coming to save us. We are the ones that we're waiting for. And we will be damned if we're going to let people who wield all the power ruin it for everyone else. So radical humanism, to me, is atheism in action. Radical humanism demands from us an analysis of our privilege. For some, radical humanism is an invitation to live into their freedom. For others, it is an invitation to deep solidarity and responsibility with the whole human family, especially with what philosopher Franz Fanon called the wretched of the earth. The humanism I'm describing is radical in its return to basic commitments with the urgency of our present moment. A fearless engagement with the complexities of life as represented by an intersectional analysis of race, gender, and class. And as such, radical humanism presents a critique of modern humanism, which has too often become distracted by bourgeois concerns of the ruling class or the middle class. So in the face of the empty promises of Christian scripture and tradition, we are faced with a challenge. How ought we to live? Congregations like this one are swimming against the current. People are less religious than ever before. And I define religious in this sense as like gathering together to do what we're doing right now. Whether you believe in a God or not, religion is about coming together and sharing our values with one another and reinforcing those values and bringing up our children with a certain way of thinking about the world and engaging in the world on the basis of those values. To me, that's like religion in a positive sense. But more than ever, people need community in which they can hammer out the ethical commitments that will make our democracy healthy and continue to progress towards equality and freedom. And I think that's what makes these congregations like yours so important, and other humanist congregations like Oasis Communities and Sunday Assemblies and other types of congregations that gather from place to place, from time to time, to really face life squarely and decide what kind of people we want to be. We have a lot of challenges facing us right now. I live in Pasadena, which is probably about as close to the image of Pleasantville as anyone could get. You know, I mean, you're in Fullerton, so you probably get it. Like, it's a nice place, right? It's a nice place with nice people. But there are hidden problems. In my community, we are facing a record number of unjust evictions, for example. I'm one of my main political activism is around tenants' rights. And so we're seeing, you know, landlords evicting tenants in record numbers for no reason other than they want to, you know, put a fresh coat of paint and raise the rent. And so for me, humanism means standing in solidarity with my fellow citizens as they're being pushed out of their homes onto the street with no plan and nothing really from city council that would say, here's what you do next, right? You're just without your house. 60 days and you're out. And so that's one way. You know, we look at a broader picture. We see the border crisis. We see attacks on ethnic communities, racial communities, genders, transgender individuals. We see attacks on people everywhere, and we can be a little bit overwhelming. But I find that this commitment, this sense that there are no promises and it's up to us to be the galvanizing thing that really connects me to others and makes me want to get involved in whatever way I possibly can. So thank you for listening.
Offering is a vital way we show our gratitude for this community. By giving to UUCF, we know that this community of caring will continue to do its good work in the world. We thank you for your generosity. Thank you.
For our opening or closing hymn, we will be singing hymn number 1021, Lean on Me. Please rise in mind, body, or spirit and join us in singing.
Extinguish the chalice this morning, but not the light of truth nor the fire of commitment, those we hold in our hearts until we meet again. Please join hands while we sing Go Now in Peace. Go now.